So, welcome to the lecture number 9. Topic today is electronic spectroscopy. Okay. Here we go. Yep. So we follow Pollas chapter 7, and we start from simple systems and then go towards small complex molecules. We don't treat atomic spectroscopy here. In Pollas's book, you can read atomic spectroscopy if you like. But we start from diatomic molecules, and therefore we are going to go through a little bit of molecular orbital theory as a refreshment of your memory, because molecular orbital theory is the tool with which we can understand electronic states of molecules. Because our task in spectroscopy is to understand the electronic level structure, we need to understand the electronic states of the molecule. And the molecular orbitals we construct as linear combination of atomic orbitals, which can be described in this way, that the molecular orbital psi is a linear combination of molecular atomic orbitals chi with the coefficient ci. So, and this is a good approach because we understand atomic orbitals pretty well. And there are certain rules for making good combinations. The energies should be similar. It makes sense because if we combine two atomic orbitals and one is very much low weight energy, it doesn't make sense for the electron to stay on the higher energy orbital. So they should be of the similar energy. There should be as much overlap as possible. And they must have same symmetric properties. And with these rules in mind, we construct molecular orbitals. The condition three, the symmetric condition, can be illustrated here. For example, if we would like to combine two s orbital with a 2px orbital in this geometry, there is zero overlap, which we can see from the fact that there is positive and negative phase of the orbital on the p orbital, and when you they overlap with the totally positive phase of the 2s orbital, the positive one makes an equally large contribution, positive contribution, as the negative makes negative, and they cancel, and there is effectively zero overlap. And this is because of symmetry reasons. So they don't combine because of different symmetry. Generally, for the homonuclear diatomic molecules, there linear combinations of atomic orbitals look like this. We can, for example, form two combinations. We mark plus or minus. In plus combination, we have pi one plus pi two, and in minus, we have pi one minus pi two, and we have a normalization factor. I'm going pretty fast because this should be somewhat familiar. So the positive combination yields a bonding orbital and a negative antibonding. And there is a note because the orbitals, they cancel the amplitudes in the area between them. And then in this way, we form molecular orbitals and we label these orbitals using the atomic orbitals where they derive from and the symmetry species of the molecular orbital. And we additionally use asterisk to describe antibonding character. And from the symmetry labels, we have G and U, so gerade, ungerade, subscript, which implies symmetry or antisymmetry, respectively, to inversion through the center of the molecule. So at the symmetry course, you learn to derive these symmetries. Here we just make a note that you can understand these symbols. So this shows examples of what kind of orbitals we get, starting from the bottom, 2s, 1s orbitals. From those, we can form two orbitals, bonding and antibonding. And we label them, basically sigma tells about the symmetry of the orbital. It's axially symmetric. Gerade is the inversion symmetry. So it's symmetric in the lower one and antisymmetric in the upper one. And 1s tells you that these molecular orbitals are derived from 1s atomic orbitals. So that's the way to label. When we go up, for the same thing, for the 2s, basically similar kind of orbitals. Again, sigma gerade, sigma ungerade, and star asterisk, each antibonding. And now these were derived from 2s, so that is included in the label. Then we go up, we come to 2p orbitals, and we have two groups of them. So we label x and y separately because we have defined x and y coordinates so that it is not the main axis of the molecule. So these p orbitals form pi molecular orbitals. And lower one is bonding pi orbital. So it's pi symmetry and ungerade. You see that because it's plus upstairs, minus downstairs, inverse and it's antisymmetric. And the next one up here is pi again, but it's gerade. You can see that the inversion is symmetric. And asterisk because it's antibonding and it is derived from 2p atomic orbitals. So that's the labeling. And finally, upstairs we have 2pz. So the p orbital, which is oriented along the interatomic axis. And again, we have a gerade orbital, bonding gerade. And then we have a sigma orbital, and we have sigma ungerade derived from 2p. So that is how we label the orbitals and how they look like. Then we have the energies for the orbitals, and there, if we have very large energies between atomic orbitals, we can guess how the molecular orbitals are ordered. So 1s orbital is very deep in energy. So that is the lowest one also for the molecular orbitals. And then 2s derived orbitals also higher. And then we come to p orbitals, and there it is not intuitively clear what is the order anymore. Certainly we have the bonding orbitals, low in energy, and antibonding orbitals, upper one. But in fact, the order of sigma gerade and pi ungerade orbitals is not clear. We have to know this from some detailed calculation, because the energetic order of orbitals for the first row elements except oxygen and nitrogen is this one. So of course we have sigma gerade 1s, sigma ungerade 1s, sigma gerade 2s, sigma ungerade 2s. But then we have sigma gerade, and then pi ungerade, and then the antibonding ones. But for oxygen and nitrogen, the sigma gerade 2p and pi ungerade 2p, they are switched. So the pi orbital is low. And this is something you cannot know. So this, this is detailed. Anyway, so in this way, we can put the molecular orbitals in energetic order. And then After that, we just fill the orbitals with electrons. So we put all the electrons in. And for example, for nitrogen, we have altogether 14 electrons to put into molecular orbitals. And then we just feed them in 2 electrons at the time for sigma and 4 to the pi orbitals. And then we fill all the orbitals. And this description here is the electron configuration. So it tells us how the what are the molecular orbitals, what is their order, and how the electrons are fed into the molecular orbitals. Then we have the bond order, which is half times net number of bonding electrons. So we can see that we have 2, 4, 8, 10 bonding electrons, and we have 2, 4 antibonding electrons. So we subtract from 10, 4, so we get 6, and then bond order is half of the 6, so it's 3, so this is a triple bond formally. Okay, so then let me tell you at this point that this is not yet electronic state, this is electron configuration. We come to electronic states a bit later. Then analogous treatment can be done for heteronuclear diatomic molecules. But there, of course, we have to worry about the energetic order of the atomic orbitals. For homonuclear orbitals, atomic orbitals, for homonuclear molecules, we always have the same energy for the corresponding atomic orbitals. So that's not a problem. But for heteronuclear, it's not the case. But anyway, for example, NO, we have the following description, which shows the order of the molecular orbitals. And now you can notice that the last one, the antibonding pi orbital, there is only one electron there. So that tells you that this is a radical, that is unpaired electron. Okay, this is a magnetic molecule. And important thing to know is that if atomic orbitals are very different, you can still construct them, but then they remain atomic-like. And you can actually consider them to remain like atomic orbitals. Here is an example for HCl. So for HCl, we have 1s orbital of hydrogen atom, and then we have the p orbitals of chlorine. And we can see that in the case A, we have a nice bonding sigma orbital formed with the 3pz. But due to symmetry properties, the 3px and 3py atomic orbitals don't combine with the hydrogen 1s, and they remain atomic-like. So the bond, the covalent bond, is formed with the 3pz orbital, and the two other p orbitals, they are like an atom. They don't take part in the bond formation. Okay, so now we have basics of molecular orbital theory. And as always in spectroscopy, we have to state the electronic states or electronic levels. And then the next task is to define the selection rules between them. Then we know what transitions between what levels are allowed. And for that, we need to classify electronic states based on some properties of them. And when we start from diatomic molecules, the electronic states, they are well-defined and transitions are accurately assigned. So we need to we can have a systematic way of labeling and defining the electronic states for diatomic molecules. But when we go to larger molecules, it becomes more complex. And moreover, if we go to solids or liquids, we have environmental interactions and the description becomes more qualitative. So we can say that, for example, when you measure some larger molecule absorption spectrum in a solution, you get some quite broad features in the spectrum, which may not be able to accurately define what the transition is. But if you measure for diatomic molecules in gas phase, you can get a lot of very accurate sharp transitions, and you can know exactly what they are. Now, we already wrote the electron configuration for a couple of molecules. And from this electron configuration, we can derive electronic states. And we have actually done this at the symmetry and group theory course. And now we are not going to go through how we derive these states. It involves a procedure of coupling of angular moment. And I will just briefly tell you what it means, but we are going to just try to understand the label system, but we are not going to derive these states here. In Holler's book, the derivation is given, so you are very welcome to read that, but it is a bit more specialized. The point is that when we have some molecular orbitals, most of the time the molecules around us, they are on the ground state. For example, something like this. This is a high energy orbital which is not occupied. And we see that in this case we have a closed shell molecule. So we have all the electrons are paired. This is these are typically stable molecules. And if we remember that each electron has angular moment, it has spin. But in addition to spin, it has orbital angular moment. So when it goes around the nucleus, it has this orbital angular moment. But as long as they are paired, these angular moment are kind of cancelled. So we have the two pairs, both the spin and the orbital angular moment in chemistry. So we have always basically zero angular moment state. But when we make an excited state, can be described in this way. So now we have unpaired electron here, and we have unpaired electron here. And this electron has orbital angular momentum and it has spin angular momentum. And this electron also has orbital angular momentum and spin angular momentum. And now we have four different kinds of angular momenta, and they can couple in different ways. We can think them like they can be parallel or opposite to each other. And they can kind of cancel each other, or they can be in the same direction. And depending on how we do this, we can have many possibilities. For example, here spins are both up, but we can also have spin up and spin down. And the orbital angular moment can also couple in different ways. So in this way, single electron configuration like this leads to many electronic states. And each state has a different total angular momentum and different spin angular momentum. And this is a procedure that leads to different electronic states. And now I'm just showing you how this labeling contains information about this. And I show you two examples of labels. These are typical labels we use for electronic states of diatomic molecules. And they contain information. First of all, we have this main label. Here it's pi, this is a pi state, and down it's a sigma state. And that main label is, it reflects the orbital angular momentum of electrons. And here we have already taken into account this individual electrons, coupling of them. So this is a total orbital angular momentum that electrons have. And the system is such that sigma means zero angular momentum, pi means one unit of angular momentum, delta means two units of angular momentum, etc. So in these two examples, downstairs here, we have zero angular momentum, orbital angular momentum, and upstairs we have one unit of orbital angular momentum. So that is the main label of the state. Then upstairs left, we have multiplicity, and that is that tells you what is the spin state, total spin state of the molecule. And it is equal to 2s plus 1, where s is the total spin quantum number. And now, so in total spin quantum number, we already take into account individual spins, how they are coupled. And how it is calculated is shown here. So the capital S is S1 plus S2, S1 plus S2 minus 1, minus 2, and so on, down to S1 minus S2 and absolute value of that. In case of two spins, if we have more spins, we have so S1 plus S2 plus S3 and so on. So more complicated. So now, if I have only one electron, one unpaired electron, like in NO, so what is the multiplicity then? Let's see. I have only one as lowercase s. And what is the spin of electron? What is what can s, the values s can take?
One half.
Yeah, so half. So basically half. So we have only half. So if I have one electron with half, then 2 times half is 1. Plus 1 is 2. So if I have one unpaired electron, multiplicity is 2, and we call this doublet state. And it is doublet because it means there are two states. We can have the spin up and spin down. What if I have two unpaired electrons? What values m can take? It is a case like this. This is a very common case because we start from the closed shell molecule and we make excitation. So we have two unpaired electrons. So what multiplicities we can have? Yes, 1 and 3. Because so now S can take values of S1 plus S2. And if we have half plus half, that is 1. Okay. And if S is 1, then 2S plus 1 is 3. So that is 3. Now, if we follow this series, we have half plus half, so it's 1 minus 1. 1 minus 1, that's 0. And it is actually the same as absolute value of S1 minus S2. So we can have two values for S. We can have 1 or 0. And if it's 0, then 2S plus 1 is 1. So as you said, we have 1 and 3. So the multiplicity can be either 3 or 1. Yes?
I want to have minus 1.
We cannot have minus 1 because, well, the S can take only value of half.
Yeah, okay, minus half
and minus. I mean, S can only have value of half. The MS can take minus half or plus, but S is only half. So if we take half plus half, it's 1, and the series goes only down to S1 minus S2 and absolute values. So it goes only to zero, doesn't go further. Was that the question? Yeah, okay, so now, so two, and that means that we can have two states, and we can understand this by thinking that we have two spins, and if the spins are parallel, so we would describe it like this. This is a half plus half, so it's a triplet state. Multiplicity is free, or if they are anti-parallel, then we cancel, and this is a singlet state, and multiplicity is one. So this is what we talk about, singlet and triplet. So it means two unpaired electrons with parallel or anti-parallel spin. And altogether, it also tells us that when S, capital S is, or multiplicity is one, capital S is zero. So we have only one state because no, there are no more states. But if capital S is one, we can have quantum number MS can take values of one, zero, or minus one. So it's the magnetic quantum number of the angular momentum. So there are actually three states. So that's why this is multiplicity. It tells us what is the, how many states, degenerate states we have. So for this triplet state, we have actually three states, which are degenerate, same energy. Okay, so that tells you about the spin state. And the logic here is that the main symbol tells you about the angular momentum state, and this one tells you about the spin state. Okay. And this post subscript gerade ungerade, again, it tells you about the symmetry of the state, symmetry with respect to inversion. And it is either symmetric G or antisymmetric U. And finally, we have this post superscript, which can be plus or minus. And that tells you about the symmetry with respect to reflection across any sigma V plane containing the internuclear axis. Minus is antisymmetric and plus is symmetric. So altogether, these labels tell you about angular momentum state and the symmetry state. And the point is that because the selection rules depend on the both symmetric and angular momentum state, because we have the great conservation laws for angular momentum, and the symmetry is also something which affects the selection rules. So that leads us to electronic selection rules, and they are like this. So delta lambda, where lambda refers to the main label, orbital angular momentum, it's zero or plus minus one. So that means that we can have transitions like this, sigma, sigma, because there it is delta lambda is zero, or sigma pi, there it is one, or pi delta, but we don't have sigma delta because then it would change by two. So that would be forbidden. So this selection rule tells us that we can have that kind of transitions. Delta S is zero, so spin state should not change. And this selection, all the selection rules always break down at some point. So they are not extremely strict. So there are factors which break them down, but it is a good starting point. And if we have heavy atoms like iodine, then this breaks down. But otherwise, spin state should not change. So we should have singlet or triplet transitions. They are allowed. And even we will come to this later in more detail. But when we talk about emission, when we have spin allowed emission, so basically, from singlet to singlet or triplet to triplet. This is called fluorescence. So that's a definition of fluorescence. It is allowed emission. And spin forbidden emission, we call it phosphorescence. And you know that phosphorescence is very long lived. It can live even macroscopic times, like seconds or minutes. It's because it's a forbidden transition, and that's why it is slow. And then symmetry labels,
plus plus allowed, minus minus allowed, but not plus minus.
And gerade ungerade allowed, but gerade gerade not, and ungerade ungerade not. So with these labels, you can then, if you are given the states, you can determine which transitions are allowed. Now we can interpret spectra, and I have a couple of examples. Electronic states of oxygen molecule. This is interesting because it's very common. And we have ground state electronic configuration gives rise to actually three electronic states. So if I write the electronic configuration, for all these states, it is the same, but the states arise because of different coupling of angular momentum. So we have triplet state, we have two sigma states, we have sigma, two sigma states, and one delta state, and then the symmetry labels for them. So we have three electronic states. And now we have already encountered potential energy curves. So this is a correct form of a potential energy curve for oxygen. And this shows that we have, for each electronic state, we have different kind of curve. So this tells us that the lowest curve, that is the ground state. That's where the molecules are most of the time. And it's a bit bad picture here, but this state is the triplet sigma gerade minus. So it's this state on the left. So that is the ground state of oxygen molecule. And you can immediately see that it is a triplet state. So normally triplet states of molecules are reactive. And well, oxygen is to some extent reactive. But it's quite exceptional. Most of the molecules we have, they are single state, the stable molecule. But oxygen is a triplet state. Then we have the first excited state. It's a singlet delta G state. And the energy here is approximately 100 kilojoules per mole. So it's quite low line state. And the next state is the singlet sigma gerade plus. Also quite low line state. So we have altogether three electronic states for oxygen molecule at fairly low energy. Then comes a big gap, and then the next state is a triplet sigma gerade plus at much, much higher energy. And the curve, if you go to large distances, all these curves dissociate to ground state, triplet P oxygen atoms. Okay, and now you can see that what about the transition from the ground state to the first excited state? So from triplet sigma gerade minus to singlet sigma gerade plus. Would you say that this is allowed or forbidden? Yes, by what rule? Yes. So this is a triplet to singlet, so it is being forbidden. There are other forbiddenness. We have gerade gerade, and that was forbidden, and we have minus plus, and that is forbidden. So it's strongly forbidden transition, which is actually pretty good for some reason. I will tell you, but what about the next one? Same thing. Also, the transition from the ground state to the second excited state is forbidden because it is spin forbidden. It is also angular momentum forbidden, sigma delta transition, also gerade gerade. So both transitions are strongly forbidden, which is very good because, for example, the energy of this transition to the second excited state occurs in a red part of the spectrum. And if it was an allowed transition, it would be quite colored, everything here, because oxygen would absorb red part of the spectrum. But It is interesting that if you prepare your molecule by some way, here on the excited state, it's a very long lived state because of a very forbidden nature of transition. So in the gas phase, 72 minutes is the lifetime. And it is in aurora borealis, what happens is that we excite the gas molecules in the atmosphere. We have oxygen atoms, nitrogen atoms, but also oxygen molecules excited. And when it's excited, it remains a long time here, and then it emits slowly radiation to the ground state, which is a red emission. That's part of the aurora borealis emission. Here's another example, C2, quite complicated set of potential energy curves, lots of electronic states, low-lying electronic states. This is important molecule in combustion. So if you look at the candle, there is a lot of C2 molecules in the gas phase which emit radiation from excited states. So in combustion, we generate C2 molecules and they get excited. So that part of the emission that we see is due to this molecule. So there is electron configuration and we have lots of states here, and the two lowest states are very close to each other in energy. And this symbol here refers to the lowest curve, and that is a singlet sigma gradient plot. So it's a closed curve. But we have this next state, next lowest state is a triplet pi 1 gradient. And here we have a sigma gradient triplet minus. So we have lots of electronic states. So that is the way how we understand electronic states of atom molecules in great detail. And how we have obtained this information is via spectroscopy. So you prepare the molecule and you observe a lot of transitions and you try to understand the transitions. And from that understanding, you can build this kind of potential energy curves. Now we have a couple of notations. You can see that, for example, here we have capital X and then we have capital A. And there is no B, but there is C and so on. And then we have lowercase B, B, E, C, and so on. And notation is such that the capital letters refer to the states of the same multiplicity as the ground state in the order of increasing energy. So the ground state is already always given label of X, as here, X. But then you know that, yeah, this state is the ground state. Then if the ground state is singlet, then the singlet states in increasing order are labeled A, B, C, D, and so on. For example, you can see that the next singlet state is this one, and that is given label A. Next one should be B, but I don't see B here. So probably there is lacking information. There may be a B state somewhere, but it is not known yet. Also, okay. Is it
above the X?
Well, but this is lowercase. Yeah. So because the lowercase labels are given electronic states of the different multiplicity in the order of increasing energy. So the first triplet state is given A, and next one is B, and so on. Sometimes it happens that, for example, here we have B state here, and we have C state here. Oh, okay, yeah, C. That C goes here, and then D is this one. Yes, so A, B, C, D. So that's the labeling. It tells you that what is the ground state, what is the multiplicity, and what is the order of the states. So that is of. So in this way, via spectroscopy, we have gathered a detailed understanding of diatomic molecules and their electronic states. Now, when we talk about electronic transitions, we tend to think first in terms of electron configuration, that electron is excited to different orbital. And then from these electron configurations, we can have many electronic states, and they can be described by potential energy curves for the states. But when we go to the transitions, we don't, in a transition, we don't just change the electronic state, but at the same time, we change the vibrational state somehow. So we excite electron to a different orbital, and at the same time, we excite molecular vibration. So normally, we have both electronic and vibrational excitation. So for each state, each electronic state, we have a stack of vibrational states. And we have to consider what happens to the vibrational states. And we can have basically all kinds of vibrational state excitations. This shows different possibilities. For example, we call progressions such groups of transitions which start from the same vibrational level. For example, in the left, this is a ground vibrational level. And then we can have transitions to different vibrational states on the upper state. For example, from 0 to 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, blah, blah, blah. And that is perfectly allowed. Remember that in vibrational spectroscopy, we have delta V plus minus one. So we have only one unit change. But in electronic spectroscopy, we can change simultaneously with electronic transition by any amount. If we start from one, we can have the same thing. We can go to 0, 1, 2, blah, blah, blah. And this tells you that if I start from zero level only, I should see many bands with almost equidistant spacing of peaks in the spectrum corresponding to different vibrational levels of the upper state. And on the right, we can of course have the same in the emission. So when we excite the molecule, it can relax via emission, and in emission, we can have transitions to different vibrational levels of the ground state. Then we have also can have transitions which are called sequences, where delta V is zero or delta V is one. So we have transition from 0 to 0 or 1 to 1, 2 to 2, and so on. But the main message is that any vibrational transition is in principle possible. No restriction on delta V. And these vibrational transitions which accompany electronic transition are called vibronic. We have vibronic transitions. And even, remember, if we are in a gas phase, for each vibrational state, we have a stack of rotational levels. So in reality, we can have raw vibronic transitions. So at the same time, also rotational state can change. And that can lead to very huge number of peaks in the spectra if we have a high enough resolution. So all these many transitions form a something called band. So it's a broad set of transitions. And now it depends on initial population of states. What are the initial states? So the initial states are populated according to Boltzmann equation. So again, population of state n V prime prime compared to n zero, so that's the ground state, is given by the Boltzmann population factor. And so, of course, for vibrations, the energy difference is quite large usually. So we mostly have only ground state populated, but can have some population on a first level. But of course, if you take into account rotational states, we have a great number of states populated. Here's an example, iodine molecule. So this whole thing is basically one electronic transition. It's a band. But we see this zigzag structure there. It's not noise. But
These are vibronic transitions. So each peak, each sawtooth, is one vibronic transition from certain vibrational level of the ground electronic state to some vibrational state of the upper electronic state. And we have labeling here. And so if we go upstairs here, we have V prime prime is zero. And you may remember that this prime prime means lower state. So this means that these transitions, which are marked by lines, originate from the ground vibrational state. And there are very many of them. And here, the labeling has been done. So the 20 has been marked, 25, 30, 40, 50. And that refers to the upper vibrational state, V prime. So all these transitions are transitions from the ground electronic state, excited electronic state, from the zero vibrational state to various upper vibrational states. So it is something like this. So this is the ground state. We start from here, and we have the excited state, and we have many, many, many vibrational states like this. And what we see here are all these kind of, you see? So we have many transitions to different vibrational states, and for each vibronic transition, we have one peak. So we have lots of peaks. We have a second sequence here. V prime prime is one. So these transitions originate from the first excited state, a vibrational excited state. So they start from here. One. And we have transition from here. Okay. Now, this is populated in room temperature because the energy difference is not so great. And even we have some transitions originating from P prime prime is two, which are observable here. So each peak corresponds to one individual vibronic transition. And all together, taken all together, they correspond to one electronic transition, but many, many vibronic transitions. And so this electronic transition is marked here. It is from singlet sigma gerade plus to triplet phi zero wund gerade plus, a bit tricky labeling system. Anyway, formally, this is a spin forbidden transition. But because we have heavy atoms, it becomes weakly allowed. If you look one individual peak, it looks a bit like sawtooth. It's not symmetric peak. And this is because if I would go to this one transition and I would be able to measure a high resolution, it would contain thousands of transitions, thousands of individual peaks corresponding to raw vibrational transitions. So that there's a huge number of rotational transitions. In this spectrum, they are not resolved. So they all coalesce into one lump. There is no resolution. But in reality, one peak contains thousands of rotational transitions. So if one would measure this with a great spectral resolution in a condition where all the raw vibronic transitions would be seen, it would contain many, many thousand sharp peaks. Okay. Now we come to a very important principle, Frank quantum principle. This principle tells us what is the intensity distribution of vibronic transitions. Where is the maximum? What is the strongest? And what kind of vibronic transitions we can see? So in principle, there is no restriction for delta V, but Frank quantum principle tells us what is the intensity distribution. There are two ways to understand Frank quantum principle. First one is classical, and the second one is quantum mechanical. I like more the quantum mechanical, but let's see the Frank. So this is classical Frank principle. And here, everything starts from the potential energy curves because they describe the electronic states. And here we must think classically. So we can consider, for example, we can think this as a classical ball system, where ball is going up and down in its well, and the lower state, if it's in on the ground state, it is at equilibrium. The ball is here on the bottom. So, or if it's a spring system, we are here and we don't move. Okay, and then we make a transition to upper state. And the first thing to note is that electronic transition is much, much faster than nuclear motion. And that means that the transition should occur vertically. So the structure should not change because nuclear don't have time to respond. So we should draw a straight line up to the upper state, and mostly our transition would occur here. Because if it would occur here to the bottom of the upper state, it would involve rapid motion of nuclear. So the first idea is that it should occur vertically, and it would end up here at the point of the potential energy curve, which corresponds to the vertical transition. So here we see that if upper state is displaced with respect to the lower state, then we don't go to the bottom of the potential, but we actually excite the molecule here at the B point. Second case is if they are actually at the same equilibrium geometry, then we can have a question that, are we going to make a transition from A to B or to C? And the answer is that we go to B, because if we go to C, it would correspond to change of velocity, change of momentum, because here upstairs the system moves. And here we don't move in A. So in this case, we would preferentially see transitions here to the bottom of the upper state. So this principle tells us that now what kind of vibrational excitation we will see depends on position of these potential energy curves with respect to each other. In A case, they are shifted. So the upper state has a longer equilibrium distance. And there we would expect to see high vibrational transitions. So vibrational transitions would correspond to excitation of high vibrational states. But in a B case, where they are, we have the same equilibrium distance of the potential minimum, we would expect to excite the ground vibrational state, no high excitations. And now we do the same in quantum mechanical way. And the transition, vibronic transition intensity, is proportional to overlap integral of two vibrational states and the square of that. And that factor, square of the overlap integral, is called Frank quantum factor. And here we have the lowest vibrational state and upper vibrational state wave function, and their overlap gives us the intensity of the vibrating transition. Now we can see the same thing again as classical. So in case where we have a displaced potential minimum on the upper state, remember that starting from the ground state, we have a Gaussian type of a vibrational wave function. And when we excite to the upper state, we have also, for the zeroth state, we have Gaussian type of wave function, but displaced. So if I would calculate overlap integral of this function with this function, so this is a displaced, there would be not much overlap. So Frank quantum factor would be very small. So zero transition would be very big. But if I go to higher vibrational states, you see that now I have a wave function like this. And there is a significant overlap. You see it from the picture. A significant overlap with this V is equal to four state to the ground. So what you do is that you calculate the vibrational wave functions of the upper state and lower state, and you calculate the overlap integral, take a square, and that gives you intensity distribution. So you would expect to see many transitions, and the highest intensity would correspond to state which correspond to vertical transition, but you would see many vibronic transitions, and intensity would die both up and down in energy. So in this case, we should see something like this kind of spectrum. Okay, so we would see several transitions, and the maximum would correspond to vertical transition. And that corresponds to case B. But if they are at the same equilibrium distance, so something like this, now we see that there will be very large overlap integral for the 0-0 transition, but already for the 0-1, it is much, much smaller. And so we should basically see one very strong peak, 0-0 transition, and then perhaps one and two states, upper states also. So it would not be a broad distribution of transitions, but most intensive would be 0-0, and then maybe 0-1, maybe 0-2. So spectrum looks very different, and that gives you information about the equilibrium distance of the excited state compared to ground state, how the potential energy curves are situated. And that can tell you about the nature of the transition. If you go from bonding to antibonding orbit, if you excite electron to antibonding orbit, what happens is that your bond weakens and equilibrium distance shifts to longer distances. And then you would expect to see this kind of progression of many, many peaks. But if you excite something maybe from to non-bonding orbital or from bonding to bonding orbital, so you don't change much the bonding properties, then you would see this kind of intensity distribution of vibronic transition like A. Good. You can also have repulsive states. But here, this is hydrogen iodide. It has several repulsive states which don't have minimum at all. In this case, we don't have discrete vibrational states, but only continuum states. And we don't see discrete structure, just a broad spectrum. And interestingly, if you excite molecule to this kind of repulsive state, what will happen is molecule will dissociate in one vibration because there is no bound state. So you have a HI molecule, then you excite it will in one vibration, it will dissociate and lead to hydrogen atom and iodine atom. So this is a way to dissociate molecules. This is called photodissociation. And that gives you broad spectrum, no vibrational structure. Okay, so that tells you that for diatomic molecules, we can have a, especially if we do spectroscopy in gas phases, we can have a very detailed information on the electronic vibrational and rotational states and angular momentum and everything. So this is quite detailed. Now we go to polyatomic molecules. So of course we have a huge variety of polyatomic molecules, but starting point is the same. We should construct molecular orbitals and electronic states, but it becomes much more complex. So we have to use much more simplified description. So we lose details. And we use symmetry arguments are very important, but if there is no symmetry, then it becomes not so detailed anymore. And we have to suffice for more simple treatment. But we can still use simple descriptions for certain chemical groups, For example, as an example, we have formaldehyde, and whenever we have aldehyde group in the molecule, we can have similar kind of treatment. So for formaldehyde, we have basically three important molecular orbitals shown here. So the first one is a bonding orbital, it's clearly it's a pi orbital. So all these states concentrate on carbon oxygen center, and we form these from the p orbitals of the carbon and oxygen atoms. The first one is a pi orbital. It has a label 1v1. V1 refers to the symmetry of the orbital. The next one is also pi, but it's antibonding, so it's 2v1 pi star. And the next one is a non-bonding. So it's not bonding or antibonding, it's non-bonding, it's atomic. And it's because of the symmetry. And this is labeled N and 2v2. So this shows that in this kind of situation, we label the orbitals again based on the symmetry pi star N. And the energy level structure is such that in the ground state, we have full occupation for both 1v1 and 2v2. 2v2 is the non-bonding. And there is no occupation on the antibonding pi orbital. And then the ground configuration can be written this way. And the ground state X is singlet A1, and A1 refers to the symmetry of the state. Then if we excite the one electron from the 2v2 orbital to 2v1 orbital, and we have two unpaired electrons, and which leads to two kind of states. So we have triplet state and we have singlet state. And now we have a different labeling system. We can call these states also N pi star state, and that labeling system refers to where the unpaired electrons are. So this N pi star tells us that we have unpaired electron on N orbital and pi star orbital. And pi star state refers to the unpaired electron residing on pi and pi star orbitals. So it's kind of shorthand way of labeling states. We lose information, but we still maintain the description of where the unpaired electron is. So, and then finally, we can describe it in this way. So this is the energy level scheme. So we have the ground state, and electron configuration can be given N2 pi 2. So we have two electrons on both. Then we have the N pi star state. And for the N pi star, we have both singlet and triplet. And then we have pi pi star. And for the pi pi star also, we have singlet and triplet. So this labeling system, well, we come to this later again, but is labeled according to the multiplicity. So the singlet states are labeled with S, and then 0, 1, 2 refer to the state number from the lower to high energy, and same for the triplets, P1, P2, and so on. So there are multiple labeling systems. And as a rule of thumb, the triplet state is always lower in energy than the singlet state corresponding to the same electron configuration. So notice that these two states, they have the same electron configuration, but spin state is different. Okay. And this is how the spectrum looks like. So this is a low resolution. This could be from the liquid phase or low resolution in gas phase. So what you see is two bumps. And here on x-axis, we have wavelength, the nanometers. So two bands, we have a N pi star and pi pi star transition. And we go back. So it would correspond to this transition to N pi star state or pi pi star state. And these are singlet transitions because they are allowed. And this is a high resolution spectrum of one of the transitions. So if you go to gas phase and we measure high resolution,
it would actually look like this. So we have many, many sharp peaks, and these are vibronic transitions. Now we have many different vibrations. So, and all vibrations can have multiple excitations. So, and now this, based on the Frank-Condon factors, we have a quite complicated pattern of vibronic transitions. So this tells you that depending on the phase, so if you're measuring gas phase or liquid phase and your spectral resolution, you can have a very detailed spectrum, or you can have something like this. So this basically tells you just that here is the electronic transition, and we have all the vibronic transitions here, but we just don't resolve them. They all coalesce in one bump. So this shows that electron transition is there, but we don't get detailed information about the vibrational states. Okay, so, and this already tells you that now if you go to large molecules, which have not more complicated electronic spectrum maybe, but huge number of vibrations, and we can have, for all vibrations, we can have multiple transitions. And quite soon it happens that they coalesce into broadband. So here is a simulation. If you have one mode, like a diatomic molecule, you can have something like this for vibronic transition. If we have three modes, it is already looks something like this. So this is a small molecule, few atoms. And three modes, and if we increase the width of individual, each vibronic transition becomes a bit wider, it already looks like this. So it tells you that most of the time we see something like that in the spectra, of electron spectra, especially in liquid phase. But it is good to remember that it's still, we have huge number of individual vibronic transitions there. We just don't resolve them. They are there, like here. But I mean, all the highest envelope, all these individual transitions. But anyway, so it means that if I excite here, I excite different vibrations than if I excite here. So the molecule still behaves differently. But it tells you that when I have complex molecules, most of the time we see this kind of broad features. Okay, so of course we cannot go through all the molecules in the world. So this is just an example how we can treat them. So we basically treated diatomic molecules, and we have accurate labeling, and we have all the angular momentum states, so we have and symmetry labels. And then when we go to larger molecules, we can use something like this for the chemical groups. For example, for aldehyde group, we can use this kind of treatment and simplified treatment of molecular orbitals. Now, next, we will go through a specific class of molecules, a crystal field and ligand field. Something similar we did also in the symmetry course, but let's see from the spectroscopic point of view. So this is a large class of molecules where we have the central transition metal ion and surrounded by ligand molecules. So these ligand molecules can be basically anything. Here is example of two cases. We have hexacyanoferrate, so we have iron in the center, and we have six cyan groups. They are Cn minus, so they are charged, and the iron is charged as well. And if cyan group carries one unit of negative charge, and this is altogether 4 minus, so this is iron 2+. So we understand why they are bound. We have ionic interaction. And these are very symmetric. This is octahedron, and this is tetrahedra. So this is nickel tetracarbonyl. So in this case, this is neutral. Carbonyls are neutral, but still, of course, we have a dipole charge distribution. So, and this kind of molecules can be considered spectroscopically as transitions of the central metal ion. But the surrounding ions form kind of a crystal field where central molecular ion is. And These kind of molecules are often colored. They have nice intensive colors because these transitions are at low energies. And if we have weakly interacting ligands, which interact mostly by charge interaction, we can treat this in crystal theory. But if we have still additionally stronger chemical bonding, we have to consider ligand field theory. And in crystal field theory, as we have transition metals, we have low-lying d orbitals, and we have five of them. And if you remember that for the isolated atom, they are all degenerate, so all have the same energy. So we cannot have transitions between them. But when these orbitals are put in the ligand field, so basically surrounded by charged molecules or molecules, they are split into two groups of orbitals. Three of them with the symmetry T2G, and upper them with the symmetry 2 with the symmetry EG. So what happens in this ligand crystal field is that the degenerate 5D orbitals split into two groups of new orbitals, and there is energy difference between them. And now, because there's energy difference, we can observe transitions between these. And that gives the color to these compounds. So it's basically due to splitting of the d orbitals. And how they are split depends on the strength of interaction. And here is an example of how this is visible. So there are hexa aqua complex ions for different central ions. So water is all the time there, but central ion is different. And you see how the color changes, and color changes because the splitting, crystal field splitting, is different for different molecules. So that then gives us very nice spectroscopic compounds. Interesting question comes from occupation of orbitals. So now, although these are drawn in such a way that there is difference between energy here, they are actually degenerate. It's just so that we can differentiate between them. So there is splitting between the upper group and lower group, but this small splitting is not real. So these are degenerate and these are degenerate. So if we have one electron, of course, it's clear it goes to here. Same two or three, so it's clear that they go to the lower orbitals. And as you remember from Hund's rules, they go with the same parallel spin. Okay, but then comes a tricky question. If I put the fourth electron, does it go here with the opposite spin or upstairs here with the parallel spin? Because they would like to be with parallel spin, but there is energy cost for that. So we consider that soon. But when we go to eight electrons again, the situation is here again. So we can put six here to the lower ones and they are fully occupied, and then we have two upstairs. And after that, two subsequent electrons go to the upper orbital, and then case from D1 to D3 and then from D8 to D10 are clear. So these are the configurations that we have. In between, we have two possibilities. So we have so-called weak field high spin. That means that the splitting between EG and P2G orbitals, is energy splitting, is small. So there is a small cost of energy for the electron to go here with the parallel spin, and it is more favorable to keep the spin than to use energy to go to the higher orbital. So weak field, high spin state, then first we fill the upper orbital with the same spin, so that finally we have D5 with the parallel spins, and then we start filling from the lower orbitals with the opposite spin. So it is called high spin state because, as you can see, we go to the case where we have up to five electrons with the parallel spin. So these are very high spin states molecules. But if we have strong field low spin case, then the energy splitting is large, so large that it
it is not energetically favorable to put electron with the parallel spin upstairs, but it remains on the lower state with the opposite spin, and then this is a low spin, so we have only 2, 1, or 1 unpaired electron until we come to D6, where we have a closed shell. Yeah, and then we start filling up a lot. So then it depends on a characteristic of this crystal field, which filling of the orbit electrons we have. Okay. Right. And the point is that then we can have transitions between these states, and that gives us intense color. Just one point about ligand field theory is that in a crystal field theory, we just think ligands to be point charges. There is no internal structure. But in ligand field theory, we actually consider the ligand orbital symmetry species. And there are different symmetries. Let's not go to detail, but I just show this picture. And this shows the hierarchy of energy levels. So on the left, we have metal. So if there is no interaction of anything, we have just degenerate metal d orbitals. And on the right, we have the ligand sigma orbital. So basically orbitals which point to the metal atom. And we have three different kind of symmetries, A1G, P1U, and EG. And then if we go back to the left, the first level is a weak interaction. So weak interaction with the ligands, it gives us splitting of the d orbitals. And then we have these two sets of orbitals. But after that, we see that we have the EG orbital. We also have four ligands EG, and then those can interact to give two new sets of EG orbitals. So the splitting of the EG, but for T2G, we don't have corresponding symmetry of the ligand orbital, and that remains as it is. But in any case, in strong interaction case, we have a different kind of level structure where EG is the lowest energy orbital. Okay, so there are lots of details. And of course, one has to study in detail each case. But note that, in fact, all the states are of G symmetry. So in fact, these are forbidden transitions by a symmetry. But still, you see that there is quite intense color. So they are quite allowed in any way, despite the symmetry. And the point is that they are allowed by vibronic interactions. And what does it mean? It means basically that vibrational motion breaks the G symmetry. So if you think, when we consider this electronic transition and the symmetry, we consider rigid molecule at certain structure, and it has a certain symmetry. But if at the same time molecule vibrates in a mode which breaks this symmetry, so it distorts the structure of the molecule, then this transition becomes allowed. And all these transition metal ions, basically all these fairly strong transitions are because this vibrational motion breaks the symmetry. So we call that it is allowed by vibronic interactions. And on Thursday, we go more into the theory of this. Okay, so the point here is that as this is an important class of molecules, this ligand or crystal field transition metal complexes, and they are very spectroscopic. They are used also in many applications. The main point is that what we see here is basically transitions of the central metal ion, and these states are perturbed by the ligand molecules. So the states are split. Finally, of course, we have a huge number of molecules, and each case is different, but we have similar case as in vibrations, where we have group vibrations. So you remember that we have chemical groups which vibrate roughly at the same frequencies,
for different molecules. We have the same for electronic transitions, and we call this chromophores. So these are chemical functional groups that have characteristic transition energies. So, which does not vary much from molecule to molecule. But we can also use this to identify molecules. And here are examples. For example, the aldehyde group absorbs approximately 280 nanometers. Then we have a double bond C, C, 325, triple bond, carbon, 190, benzene ring, 260, conjugated molecules, longer than 180, and single double bond, C, C, 189. You see that these transitions are in a UV range, even deep UV range. So, of course, because the electronic transitions are quite broad, this is not so straightforward as in vibrational transitions, where it's much sharper, well-defined peaks. But anyway, so we still have this possibility to identify groups, what kind of groups we have in the molecule from the electronic spectrum, or basically try to understand the electronic spectrum based on the molecular structure. Okay, that's it. Any questions? Okay, good. Then we see you on Thursday. Thank you.